Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
The only way we can turn the gears backward, save our species, and create well-being in the world is to take carbon and make it a negative commodity that is traded in such a way as to reverse its generation and create incentives to sequester and run every business in the world in such a way as that it must measurably each year reduce its carbon footprint or it's put out of business by law. And that's where the Netherlands is heading.
It's not every day that some knowledgeable authority tells you that you need to just stop and then reverse almost everything that you're doing. That is, if you're wishing to stay alive. Extinction in nature is the rule, we're told, and Mother Nature does, after all, bat last. Do you get the connection to money and banking and all this? Well, we hope that you will after listening to our guest today here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and chair emeritus of the Public Banking Institute. Among other things, our guest today will be delving into how evolving economic needs, like reverse programming carbon production and making it have a negative worth, is one of the transformational roles that banks can play in a new and necessarily regenerative economy. While all that might sound pretty heady, it's also both exciting and extremely confrontational. Our current relationship with money and the banking institutions that manipulate it must also be transformed. Again, self-interest suggests that we don't have much choice. We're either going to transform our economies and culture out of the commodities-based matrix of extraction and consumption that we've maxed out, or we're going to perpetuate our decline and take our place in the line of the previous five extinctions that Mother Nature executed. Our featured guest is Edward Cavetto today. He's a professor and director of the Foresight Lab in San Francisco, associated with Stanford University, and an international consultant working with new models of economies that are opening new understandings and economic models for policy leaders. And money, of course, is centrally involved. That's where the transformational conversation comes in, and we're seeing a sign of that now in LA, in a pronounced way, with a campaign to win an election in November that can open the way forward for Los Angeles to create its own public bank. The Public Bank LA team of smart, youthful activists have made tremendous and impressive progress that will be put to a public test in November on a ballot question that's designed to allow the city council to investigate creation of their own public bank. It doesn't authorize bank creation, but rather clears the way for that process to begin. But it is seen as a bellwether of how the public bank idea is being received by the citizens there. We'll be talking with Mark Armstrong of Commonomics USA, who has been instrumental in helping that effort. Later on, we'll check in with Bob Bowes in his next-to-last installment about other components of transformational change that are tied to the banking sector, as we look deeper behind the curtain of monetary control by global banking interests. Ellen has been presenting public banking up and down the West Coast in recent weeks, and as they say, California tends to set the pace in creating the changes later adopted by the rest of the nation. We talked about some of the emerging topics and themes that are being brought into focus there.
Well, Ellen, this week, a lot of our content comes from people who either live in California or who are active in California, like yourself. pretty interesting to see how the new frontier of American economic and political prospects seems to come from California. Maybe it's your sunshine, maybe it's your water, maybe it's because you guys are all trying to get away from the rest of us Easterners. But public banking is certainly taking flight there. So what have you been up to in California, and how do you see things going on there?
Well, I've actually done presentations in 5 cities in the last 3 weeks. One of them was in Washington State, but the other 4 were in California. So that was Sacramento, Marin, San Rafael, and Sonoma. And the last 2 were with Gar Alperovitz, who he organized a panel for the Pioneers Conference in San Rafael. And then we both spoke at Sonoma for the Praxis Peace Institute, called Changing the System, California's Strategic Role in National Strategic Change. So Gar has proposed that we, being the 5th largest economy in the world and being progressive in the sense that we're big on being first in change and being willing to do new ideas. So he's proposing that the country is really too big to, it's not, you can't have a democracy that as big as the U.S. I mean, we the people have very little say in what really goes on. But you can have influence at your local level, like we've seen with Public Bank L.A. has done there in Los Angeles. This is a city of 4 million people, and yet just by going down and being active and talking to city council, they have persuaded the city council to pursue a city-owned public bank. So anyway, he was proposing that we could revise the model, and starting in California, that we obviously need some sort of new economic system. The current one's not working. Everybody's drowning in debt. There's something wrong with our money system. Why is everyone in debt? And that's because of just the way all of our money comes into existence as a debt. It's always a debt at interest. So there's never enough money to pay back the debt. So the debt always outgrows the money supply itself. And that's assuming that everybody paid back the money that they got, paid it back into the system, but they don't. Lots of people save it. It goes off into offshore tax havens, et cetera, goes out of state. It doesn't come back to our local communities. So there's never enough money to pay off the debt, so everybody's in debt, and therefore they don't have the money to spend on things they need to stimulate the economy. So if you had some free money out there or some new money, or you could get some money into the system that wasn't debt-based, you could stimulate economic growth, and we really need that. I mean, it wouldn't create inflation, what it would do, not until you're up to full productive capacity, and we're nowhere near that yet, so that's what I would argue. Anyway, so I was thinking about how to change the system. California did issue warrants at one time in 2009 when we were broke and the state hadn't passed a budget, which they were basically IOUs, but you could use these IOUs, you could trade them, you could spend them, and they were good in payment of taxes. And at a few months later, they only were around for a few months, you could cash them in plus interest. So they were really a form of bond without going through the bond markets, so avoiding the Wall Street middlemen. So anyway, we've got some precedent there. And in Greece, Yanis Varoufakis said that he was basing his alternative parallel payment system on the California system. But then the trouble with that is you're still talking debt. I mean, the state would still have to pay those advances back. And if they pay them with interest, that's going to actually tighten the money supply, not make it bigger. So I'm not just sure how we would work that out, but it is interesting. Also, you know, Fiona Ma and Bob Hertzberg, Fiona Ma is expected to be our next treasurer. She was won by a landslide in the primaries, and Bob Hertzberg is a state senator, and they brought a bill for a closed-loop system just for marijuana money, so you could deposit your money in this state-owned semi-bank and write checks on it, sort of like the old postal banking system. But it wouldn't be a full system, and it would only be in California. And that bill actually didn't pass, but the model is there, and people are thinking along those lines, like, how can we expand the system? How can we change the system? So that's very provocative and interesting, and those are possibilities. Also, when I was up in Washington State, in Seattle, it was Bob Hasegawa is a state senator, And he filed the first public bank bill in 2010. He was ahead of the curve, and he's now on his fifth bill, which is, they're very persistent. You know, they don't give up. Each time, they just modify the bill to respond to what the criticisms are. And each time, they get more support from the legislators. So they're now up to a caucus of 21 people, and they have one more who has agreed to sign on. So they're only three votes short of having a majority in the Senate. And Patty Kutcher, who is another senator who is in the caucus, she said on their last go-around, she said, well, we always come up against the same objections or the same questions. So why don't we just move right into a business plan and we'll answer those questions. We'll show you where we're going to get the capital and what kind of loans we're going to make and who's going to be involved. They have actually allocated almost $500,000 for this business plan. The legislature has passed that. And the business plan is due in June, and then they will have a bill that they hope to be able to pass in the Senate. And the other branch of government is an easier body to pass, so they're very hopeful on that. So it just shows slow and steady wins the race. They just keep plodding along, but they've actually made quite remarkable progress. And in the scheme of things, Gar Alperovitz said it at this last presentation we were at about how far the public banking movement had come so quickly. But each time we're making progress and we're getting more publicity and more awareness of what we're talking about here, what public banking is and why it's basically a no-brainer. I mean, we'll just save a lot of money and we can expand the credit in the local community, and it's all good.
It is a very exciting frontier, and the challenge that the people in government are having is how to make sense of funding their futures with the current system of dependence on private capital. So you're discussing new vehicles for exchange, whether it's to accommodate the growing cannabis market, or even more local kinds of currencies that could be exchanged through digital platforms. All of those seem to be on the table all of a sudden in a whole new way by these political and governmental leaders who are looking for some solutions. It was interesting to see that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, did a report about how most governments are unaware of their true wealth, that they don't really accommodate or don't account for their asset base. And the relevance of that, I think, is that when we're looking at having a bank that basically designed to monetize equity, to turn the assets and the full faith and credit of a city, county, state into money, that's what a bank does. It's what we ask Wall Street to do for us. And they say, well, you know, you're worth X amount of dollars, and we'll give it to you, but it's going to cost you this. This public bank initiative is a way to provide that, the technical ability to monetize that equity in-house. Is that a fair representation?
Yeah, no, well said and well conceived. I mentioned that Gar Alperovitz, he's head of the Democracy Collaborative and the Next System Project, which is all about how we can design the system for the next century or the next millennium, whatever, like we're just on the cusp of something new. And at our first conference in Philadelphia in 2011, I guess, we invited him to speak, and he said, I don't think you all realize what you started here. And he's now talking about California as being on the cusp of creating a model for the new system. He is sort of a visionary, so I kind of take that to heart. Like, well, all right, we got to do it.
Yeah.
Let's figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. That I remember him saying that very clearly, that you guys don't know what you started. You really don't have a sense of the dimension. And in our program today, Ellen, we're going to be hearing from Professor Ed Cavetto, also from West Coast, from Stanford, who is part of the Foresight Lab, who is similarly helping to frame the mechanics and the understanding of what a viable economy must look like in a world in which the fundamental economy is not what happens to capital, but is primarily nature. And that to the extent that our capital and economic practices violate that, this has to stop, and it has to stop immediately. I know that's not particularly news, but it is a striking sort of an observation that when we talk about public banks being a methodology to better organize our local affairs and regional affairs, we really are on the cusp of a significant new public institution that can represent public interests, biological and system interests. And so in that sense, I think Gar's comment about we don't know what we started is very prescient, because this is the door to a new way for us to reclaim some prospect of a decent future. So much so relative to Ed Cavetto's work with Foresight Lab that they're looking at taking a model to Davos, for the world's economic leaders and political leaders to confront the reality that unless our economies are working in harmony and re-geared toward reversing the practices and the outcomes of industry, he proposes that carbon will be the next currency in the next system. Carbon.
I've heard that too, but my feeling is we don't want a commodity-based currency. That limits it. It ties it down. It makes it into discrete objects, like the gold-based system. Mm-hmm. That money is not that we're coming to see, that it's really just a credit and debit system. It's credit clearing system. Yeah.
Yeah, and in that sense, I think when I say the new currency, I didn't mean that it would be carbon credits, but really that reversing carbon consumption and extraction would be part of the economic mechanism for retooling the earth. And he says in Norway, this is what's happening. They have combined their economic departments of economy with the Department of the Environment, and that they're moving toward a platform in which businesses that do not eliminate their reliance on carbon will be eliminated and will be outlawed.
Yeah, well, Gar's idea was that at the federal level we could use quantitative easing. Now that the central banks are buying up stock in the stock market, just you could buy up the 25 top oil and gas companies plus a bunch of coal companies for $1.1 trillion, which is only a bit.
That's less
than a third of what they did in quantitative easing. So,
yeah, exactly. I think that's a perfect example and a really good idea as well. And who knew?
And then you just shut them down or
right. Turn
them into public utilities that you somehow transformed. You know, save the energy component, but replace the fuel. I like the idea of alcohol-fueled cars. Henry Ford's original idea was that we would run on alcohol. I mean, you could make those cars run on alcohol just as easily as on gas, and you could have all these little farms all along the roads could be taking their weeds, you know, not the foods, but useful for anything, turning them into alcohol, and that actually is a renewable energy source. So you could be driving along, and the farmers could have their own little independent businesses, and your car could be independent, whereas now your electric car is dependent on the grid, which is centrally controlled. But you would be independent, the farmers would be independent, it would be a renewable resource. It seemed like a good idea at the time until the oil companies railroaded it down.
Well, this is very interesting, because a couple of years into this work in public banking, we really are on the cusp of a necessity to create some new institutional responses. So, you know, who knew, Ellen, that money and banking would be so fascinating and so dynamic.
Right.
This is our 99th show together. And in another 99 shows, hopefully we'll have a world that operates a little bit differently.
We'll have a bank set up by then.
Well, Ellen, I guess we'll see what happens next, huh?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our featured guest today is Edward Cavetto, who directs the Regenerative Design Program within the Foresight and Innovation Lab, a collaborative advisory and creative agency composed of educators, policy innovators, social entrepreneurs, sustainability practitioners, and nonprofit leaders that are working together to build the new regenerative economy. The new regenerative economy is a fundamental reframing of the conventional consumer economy, grounded on integrity, sufficiency, social justice, and ecological regeneration, rather than consumption, exploitation, and the destruction of the ecosystems on which we depend, for the sake of pursuing profit. Ed joined me recently for our Public Bank Solution TV program, where we discussed what the concept of regenerative design is all about.
Well, we're familiar with the regenerative economy, we just don't see it in those terms. The regenerative economy is all around us. We see it when we're driving through places of nature. The original regenerative economy is the fruits of nature that are provided as a function of biological processes that support life on the planet. And we have become arrogant and misled in our modern day, thinking that it's the ingenuity of mankind that gives us this vast material economy and all the things and stuff that we have around us that make our so-called modern life so-called comfortable. It's really alienating us from who we are. And in fact, the greatest public health crisis to face us as a species is the global material economy. It's literally killing us because we misunderstand that the entire material economy, Walt, is based on photosynthesis. The gifts of nature give us all the raw materials necessary to produce the material economy. And the pace at which we're making stuff, the pace at which we're extracting the fruits of nature from the planet, is causing radical dislocations, the collapse of ecosystems, and ultimately the shift in our climate. And if we don't stop it, nature will say of mankind or humanity, that was a bad experiment, we'll push reset, and she will eliminate us and try again. The regenerative economy has its place in the modern world in affectionate exchanges. And I'll give you one simple example. The gentleman who repairs my boot heels, I wear boots because I ride horses, is a gentleman that I've known now for almost 20 years. He runs a little shop in a town called Mountain View. I've met his family, I've met his children. I have been to his home, and when I pay him to repair my boots, I pay a little bit more than I would pay if I went to a chain cobblery. But when I give him money, it goes straight to his family and his children's well-being, and it's an affectionate exchange. If I were to go to a generic corporate-owned chain cobblery, I wouldn't know the person, and it would be a purely transactional matter. But the regenerative economy is based on the idea that when I engage in commercial exchange, I simultaneously create net gains, net measurable gains in ecological, social, and economic well-being. Now, those are very different concepts, and I'm happy to unpack it, but imagine if every transaction from the material I buy to transport me around to my mortgage to the education I buy for my children was that kind of affectionate exchange, and that with every transaction, every person on the planet was generating net measurable gains in ecological, social, and economic well-being. The problem, and I'll stop here, Walt, is that right now in the global conventional material economy, we are doing exactly the opposite. 99.999% of economic exchanges degrade real economic well-being, ecological well-being, and social well-being.
Photosynthesis is really at the source of our wealth, our common wealth, you say. But it's interesting that you point out that in business, as in nature, extinction is the rule, not the exception. So this isn't a trivial matter we're talking about here. In what ways are we stepping over that line with our current system?
I only need to tell you that the statistics just in the United States tell us that 80% of businesses that are started fail, which is fine. In nature, the natural scientists and biologists tell us that almost the exact same percentage of species that nature tries fail. Why is that the case? Because nature's model is prototyping. When she has to fill a new ecological niche, think about the extinction of the dinosaurs and we need a new capstone predator to evolve, she experiments. In industry, entrepreneurship is fundamentally an experimental gesture, but it's not what it used to be. There was a time wall in the United States when the titans of industry would talk about just what you did. They would say, we have to work for the commonwealth. In fact, the dean of the first business school in the United States, which was at Yale, said in a speech when he was trying to make the case to his faculty to create the first business school in the country, and I'm paraphrasing from a book, the book is called From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. In this speech, the dean of the Yale Business School said, if our work in the Graduate School of Business is about training hands to do well by society and hearts to increase the common good, then a business school has a place in the academy. If, on the other hand, our aim is to train brains to manipulate money, to create artificial wealth through purely economic gain, we are riding the sea of our destruction.
Wow.
And that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, and it's so true. So we've commodified the exchange between us as opposed to humanized it. To most people, I think that doesn't sound very practical because they can only think in the matrix of commodities and exchanges of physical entities. Whereas these other values that you brought in of health and happiness, well-being and humanity have been ignored. When we talk about banking, Ed, we, of course, have been discussing the public bank protocol and methodology. How is it that banking expresses the values or could express the values that you're referring to?
I think that's an angle of approach we should explore, because people will say on first hearing the things I'm talking about, and I've been told by fancy PhD toting economists who are on faculties that I've been on and by world-class executives in large banks, that these ideas are naive. And I take that seriously because these people have degrees and letters and experience that I don't have, but I also think that they are true. The most profitable bank in all of the Netherlands, which is a pretty well-run country, by any measure, margins, reinvestment, growth pace, number of investors, is a little bank called Triodos Bank. I should say it's not the largest, it's the healthiest. Not the largest in terms of turnover, but in terms of its margins, the length of time people have deposits with it, Triodos Bank is the most commercially successful by all conventional economic measures. It is a philanthropically owned bank created by a group of expats from Rabobank in 1996, and they left Rabobank to see if they could create a bank that generated net well-being rather than profit. So they created a philanthropy to hold the bank to solve a problem. Our work in the Foresight Lab, our work in the world, when we're teaching, all of it is trying to solve the problem of our alienation from nature and each other as fellow creatures. What they wanted to do with this bank was ask, could we generate net measurable gains in community well-being rather than profit? And Triodos Bank was launched, and it's been copied by the good folks at Beneficial State Bank, Tom Steyer and Cat Stevens. It's been copied by our friends at Amalgamated. And this banking model fundamentally changes one's relationship with money. We talk about, well, money circulating. It's like blood. When it moves in the economy at speed with good intention, it nourishes. Mm-hmm. It creates opportunities, mm-hmm. economic opportunities. It creates education. It creates art. When money is held by the scions of industry in big conventional banks, it gets stale and it rots because it sits in piles to make the rich richer and to immiserate the poor. And that crushing gap is the direct result of our material economy. If we reinvent banking in relationships, and if our banking relationships are affectionate, like I talked about before, banks become a whole different thing. And if you think about the wonderful movie, A Wonderful Life, that little loan and trust that Jimmy Stewart's character runs is fighting with this titanic bank that wants to gobble it up. And that's exactly what we're talking about. I think banks, and you know that banks that are publicly oriented for the common wealth and the common good can be equally profitable to or better on conventional measures, but do good in the world rather than create harm.
Yeah, much more profitable in many instances. I mean, for example, our model public bank, the Bank of North Dakota, outperforms Wall Street 2-1 in terms of its return on equity.
It has the least amount of risk. Return on equity has been 17 to 26% for the last 12 years. Pretty high marks. Well, there are some other banks that you mentioned, and we have some graphics here. I see the Triodos Bank logo says, make your money make a difference. And you mentioned Beneficial and Amalgamated. Amalgamated Bank out of New York, now a national bank, was started by the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, only to serve that community. It's all been about commitment to public well-being and public trust. So there's strength and vitality and a certain affection for each other that's implicit in that as well. Tell us about RSF, Reimagine Money. What is that in the monetary scheme of things?
RSF Social Finance is a 38-year-old financial institution based here in the San Francisco Presidio. RSF stands for the Rudolf Steiner Foundation. Uh-huh. These ideas I've been talking about are Rudolf Steiner's brilliant insights into three fields of human endeavor: agriculture, education, and finance and economics. He saw them as the same. Rudolf Steiner's fundamental gesture was this threefolding of the world of finance, education, and agriculture. And if he said in the 1930s, the brilliant Austrian biologist slash philosopher slash economist, he said, if we do not reform the way we interact with each other and nature, we will end ourselves through our chase for artificial profit. Mm-hmm. Sort of troublesomely echoing the words of Professor Biddle, the founding dean of the Yale Law School. And the basic idea behind RSF is, let us create, the basic gesture is, let us have banking and financial exchange based on trust, good intention, and a long-term view of measurable gains in well-being. Mm-hmm. So RSF has three investment portfolios: education, ecology, food, and agriculture. When you think about it, those are the three things that make life worth living. Yeah. They are the three things that are at the rootstock of any healthy economy. They invest in such a way that completely de-links their activities from the global financial markets. Instead of using the LIBOR extractive, punitive interest rate set by bankers in quiet, dark, hidden rooms, when they want to set their interest rates, they get the people that they invest in and their investors in a room, and they talk about need, human need. And they agree quarterly how to adjust the interest rate that the borrowers pay to the lenders. Mm. And if every bank in the world were based on that, we would suddenly find a way to solve every single complex ecological, social, and economic problem that we as a global society face. So we really have two choices: emulate RSF and Triodos and have an abundantly, joyfully, connectedly human future where the economy is based on inclusion, regeneration of nature, and abundance of well-being in the world, or continue on this path and face collapse of ecosystems, destruction of the climate cycle, and ultimately the extirpation of our species. To me, this is a pretty easy choice.
Yes, but as you say, an unsustainable path that we're on, which is one of the reasons that, of course, the public banking has come to the fore right now, because the cities and counties that are considering them are on an unsustainable path of more debt, of indebtedness. And there's no way, of course, they can borrow themselves out of debt. And simultaneously, there's no way that they can express or commit or enable their best sentiments, their best intentions, to improve the economy and to improve the welfare of the people for whom they serve. So they're locked into a cycle of commodification of money that prevents them from using it. As you say, it's not a tough choice if we would only take it seriously. So this business about naivete is actually on the other foot. We're foolish if we think that it's not the case, that nature rules here, and that we better resonate and replicate and regenerate ourselves in our relationships. There's a new variation, or one of the applications of money that you're involved with is the Perpetual Purpose Trust. Organically Grown Company is a large firm in California. Tell us what a Perpetual Purpose Trust is.
Organically Grown Company is a transformative natural produce company. They're actually based in Eugene with operations in Portland. And they work with RSF to take a model that we've been talking about for quite some time in the marketplace in another context, but RSF named it and built it and just took the idea and ran with it. In traditional terms, companies are held in one of two ways, to simplify. They're either held by an individual for that individual's profit, or they're held by a group of people for group profit. And they're hooked into the global material economy and banking and financial system that we've been talking about that's so problematic. The brilliant breakthrough of a perpetual purpose trust is it allows the holding of a company by a family or a community, much like amalgamated, who have one thing in common, a mutual intention to create well-being in the world. And it actually creates disincentives to grow profit. The way that the tax structure of a perpetual purpose trust works is that you're rewarded for steady state operation. Steady state economics has been studied by James Daly and a variety of other economists, and they've said that it's the only future of the global material economy because it's nature's model. This is not a subtle, naive fringe idea. It's quite central in the world of PhD-toting economists who talk about these issues. Now, PPT allows a business to operate on a steady state model. And to do so, you basically create incentives to grow slow, have intention, and do good. It goes way beyond a B corporation or even a benefit corporation to set up a permanent way of holding a business so that generations after generations of families, rather than being taxed on profit and being motivated to generate profit and artificial wealth, they actually generate well-being, do good in the world, and make a modest, sufficient profit. And I'll say that they exemplify something that we need, Walt, that I want to make sure to mention. People often see these conversations as conversations about policy reform. They're mistaken. This is a movement of social conscience that must suffuse our nation, and never has it been more important in the times that we are in now in the United States that we demand of every candidate running for public office, from the school board and the water board to the highest office in the land, that they make a commitment in their platform to pursue the regenerative economy and public banks and perpetual purpose trusts, and to hammer them by force of will, guile, and political process into the infrastructure of our nation, protect future generations against those who would hijack our future in ways that are happening right now. So if we take these ideas and convert them into the place where the future of our policies and society are forged, that is the world of elected office, we have a chance to make this real and to have it be as much a part of our everyday world as reporting on the Dow Jones Stock Exchange or any other government policy to get national attention.
Yeah. I know you have some agendas around the international economic community that would involve an understanding of carbon as the new common currency. Tell us a little bit about how carbon fits in as a currency element.
The idea comes from the fact that the Dutch ministries of climate and economy merged last year. And you would ask the question, why would a smart, progressive, intelligent, well-run country, one of the best economies in the world, merge their ministries of economics and climate? Well, I mean, it's not hard to figure out if you've been watching the long-term movie of our global economy. They realize that carbon is the new currency. If we trade carbon as an investment in our own future, and if we trade it in such a way as to make it negatively valued, we will gear down and actually reverse climate change over the long term. Right now, all we're trying to do is to slow the increase in climate change. Mm-hmm. The only way we can turn the gears backwards, save our species, and create well-being in the world is to take carbon and make it a negative commodity that is traded in such a way as to reverse its generation and create incentives to sequester and run every business in the world in such a way as that it must measurably each year reduce its carbon footprint or it's put out of business by law. And that's where the Netherlands is heading. So our goal is to go there this summer with governors of the U.S. Central Bank, with bankers, with PhD-toting economists, with students, with business leaders, and with other policy leaders. We are just beginning to plan this, but our hope is that we'll be welcomed by the Ministry of Climate and Economy in the Netherlands to study their model and to begin talking about this on a larger frame and ultimately to take this message to the World Economic Forum in a few years, where the titans of industry, government, policy, science, and education gather to set the global course of the future of our global society and tell them in no uncertain terms, the regenerative economy is what you must pursue. And if you don't, you are breaching the public trust as elected officials, fiduciaries of the future, and your social license to operate will evaporate before your very eyes if you don't pursue a path that generates plenty of economic well-being, but also heals the wounds of social and ecological dislocation that the material economy is causing, and using carbon as a negative trading commodity or currency is one of the key gears in changing that cycle.
And quickly, Ed, if I ask you about how you see the public banking development and evolution serving that purpose. How do you see that playing out?
In my estimation, every bank in the world needs to be converted by law into a public bank. We need to fundamentally change the regulations so that it's impossible for a bank to operate extractively. In the meantime, the propagation of the public bank movement, which you and your colleagues at PBI are leading, is essential to our future. It's more than interesting and helpful. It's those things for sure. It's more than inspiring and meaningful. It's those things. It is fundamentally essential to the health and survival of our nation and our species that we pursue public banks with all due vigor, because they're an exemplification of everything I've been talking about.
Well, Ed, thank you very much for that. I think that's really expanded a lot of thinking. It's a stark reality that the systems that we live in, the problem that we survive through and we tolerate, is leading us to an unsustainable future, and that there are dimensions to our economy that go outside the bounds of money, currency exchange, and commodities, but really reside in natural processes, relationship between people, the talents, the prospects, the intention of communities to work together toward the benefit of humanity. A regenerative economy, perhaps you would like to say an economy worthy of our affection. Ed, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Walt. I appreciate you having me on.
That's Ed Cavetto, Professor of Practice and Innovation at Stanford University's School of Public Policy and Director of Regenerative Design at Stanford.
Our focus on public banking stems from the fact that publicly owned banks can transform public finance in numerous ways, saving enormous sums on the cost of capital borrowed from private sources to pay for public needs in cities, counties, and states, whether those sources are from Wall Street, global banks, private equity, hedge funds, are just the start of how our finances can change with public banks. Another is the ethical part, which includes the notion of a regenerative economy, as we just talked about with Ed Cavetto, a realization that the only true economy around us is Mother Nature, and as we all know, she does bat last. Well, in Los Angeles, those ethical, earthbound, community values have come to the fore in a campaign to open the way for a public bank in the second largest city in the country. Referendum B will be decided yes or no on November 6th and could open the channel for public banking in Los Angeles. The referendum doesn't ask voter permission for a bank. It just allows the city to go down that track if it wants to. And apparently they do want to. The fact is, California is alive with movement to create public banks in at least 8 cities and communities from the top of the state to the bottom. Two of public banking's most prominent leaders, Ellen Brown and Mark Armstrong, are both on the scene in California working the campaign with a new generation of public banking leadership in the form of a group called Public Bank LA. Mark and I talked about his work underway there and about the team of people conducting a remarkable, spirited campaign that's catching fire and gaining speed.
What's always interesting about California is there's an element of surprise in that people pick this up pretty quickly. You know, when I was doing some tracking on the website and such with regards to responses to articles or whatnot, it was always at least 10 times more clicks or 10 times more interest, essentially, being shown by Californians. And so what's good is the level of interest that's shown, as well as just how quickly people pick up on this. For some reason, they're able to connect a number of things, probably because they keep it at a fairly high level and don't worry about the details, it does seem to move quicker here than elsewhere.
So what is the status, organizational status, of the California efforts at this point? I want to talk about L.A., of course, but something much bigger has grown up in the last couple of months.
There was very strong interest in developing municipal banks by anywhere from up to 8 different municipalities, from Eureka down to L.A., and over the course of the last year and a half, I'd been organizing some conference calls with divest groups in each one of those municipalities. And as a result of those conversations, everyone decided to form the California Public Bank Alliance. So the idea is to work at two levels. One is at the municipality level at each one of the different locations in East Bay, in San Francisco, Santa Cruz, L.A., et cetera. And the other is to work at a legislative level to put in place a public bank license or charter that could be issued by the Department of Business Oversight so that each one of these banks essentially can be replicated. The same idea doesn't need to be lobbied for again and again. We can all have a kind of a standard template in order to create these municipal public banks. And so that's the effort of the California Public Bank License Alliance, and it's quite interesting and exciting that they're making such progress.
And I know you were involved in the cannabis pursuit, too, around public banks, and it seems like public banking has been kind of tagged with that prospect all over the country. Where does it stand in California?
So the treasurer, John Chung, has issued an RF request for information and then a request for proposal in June, having to do with the cannabis industry and public banking. That was a good success that came out of discussions with him and the working group that he had created. And as a result of the RFP, a contract was awarded to a consulting firm out of San Diego that is currently engaged in a feasibility study, and that study will be delivered early December to the treasurer. It'll be interesting to see what sort of issues they identify, as particularly the legal ones, because there was a lot of work done on the legal side of this by a number of law firms, and sort of actions they propose to be taken.
Is it your sense that there might be a state-only workaround for that?
I hope there is. It's very doable. The reason why is because the payment system that solves a part of the problem, which is the cash-based transactions, but a payment system exists. There are two different apps, essentially, that reside on people's mobile phones that could handle the purchasing transaction, and then the money can flow directly into the state-owned public bank, into the account of the commercial cannabis provider, and so assuming they're licensed. And so that piece of it is very doable because that technology exists. What doesn't exist is the set of laws that need to be established to protect the state-owned public bank. I'm expecting that the feasibility report will likely make some suggestions in that space because, as I said, there was so much legal work done by a number of different law firms. I think they're ready to start talking about the legislative process.
What I hear you saying is that the federal law could jeopardize public bank if they're a part of the federal network.
The federal regulations could jeopardize it. What's needed is state law to basically bolster the state's rights approach on this. It just needs a little, some more law on the state side in order to make a better case for the state of California.
Well, right now you're deeply immersed in probably the most exciting and visible efforts around the country for public banks in Los Angeles. Tell us about Public Bank LA.
It's a group of folks who have worked together since the Dakota Access Pipeline. They worked together in order to put together some divestment proposals for the city of Los Angeles. And out of that came a realization that doesn't really do any good to pull money out of one bad performing Wall Street bank and put it into another bad performing Wall Street bank, that they really need to have a public bank here in Los Angeles to put all the nearly $8 or $9 billion of deposits every year. And so they formed Public Bank LA just a year ago this past July, as a result of that effort, started lobbying the city council to put in place a public bank. The city council, surprisingly, then turned around and put it on the ballot. And so ballot measure, let me just read it to you. It says, shall the city charter be amended to allow the city to establish a municipal financial institution or bank? That's it. So people who know nothing about public banking or banking for that matter will come into the voting booth and see that this is Charter Amendment B, and they will make a decision, either yes or no. And so we're hoping it's yes, of course. It is an interesting question that's on the ballot. There's no mention of a public bank. It's going to be an interesting vote in 2 weeks when this comes out on November 6th. And so at the very least, it'll be a baseline for everyone to look at, because this has been a small group of energetic young folks who are really focused on spreading the word about this using social media and video and whatnot. But there's no money to fund any outreach. But even so, they've gotten over 100 endorsements from individuals as well as organizations. Wow. And so, you know, they're doing this not even on a shoestring. It's just, you know, by the power of their energy and determination. And what's great is, you know, a lot of these folks are, you know, they're comedians. They're they have different experience in acting as well as in comedy and theater. And so this is definitely the liberal arts approach to public banking, and it's really cool to see what they're doing, and I just hope it pays off with a 51% yes vote. We'll see if it happens.
That's Mark Armstrong of Public Bank LA and the president of Commonomics USA. You can check out the progress of the LA project at publicbankla.com. Our behind-the-curtain commentary from Bob Bowes this week covers the sixth installment of his new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation. The title expresses the sweeping nature of Bob's purview as he ties together some of the historical components of our monetary and banking system and reflects on them next to our claimed values and interests. It's often a shocking story in that we learn parts of our past that no one ever told us and which have the effect of changing how we've always seen things. This week's installment is no different.
On June 5th, 1991, at a Bilderberger conference in Baden-Baden, Germany, David Rockefeller declared victory for corporate control over the state and his notion of global government. Quote, "The supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national self-determination practiced in past centuries." End quote. It is now over 27 years since Rockefeller's declaration that the cabal of which he is a part, the Anglo-Euro-American banking cartel, had, in his estimation, successfully hijacked the planet. In this segment, Step 6, Restoring Law, Science, and Logic, from our new book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, we are going to enumerate actions designed to educate the public in the hope of moving towards a tipping point of consciousness, the result of which would address, full force, the root cause of global dysfunction, private control over money creation. While many have simply thrown up their hands and given up the fight, we insist that if one is to derive any progressive and spiritual meaning from human existence, then our only choice is to resist the devolution of our species being directed by those at the top of the global power pyramid, including the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, who own the privately held holding companies that control vast numbers of key corporations and governments. While the cartel's grip on global power is firm, it is not as monolithic as it claimed, and as his co-conspirators would like us to believe. So let us enumerate a sampling of the domestic and foreign actions that would serve our strategy of education driving us to a tipping point. 1. Return money creation to the people of the United States of America. This means public control over the Federal Reserve System and a network of public banks. 2. Create a verifiable voting system, that is, eliminate electronic voting and counting machines, and institute oversight of paper ballots from beginning to end of the electoral process overseen by international observers. 3. Decentralize the mass and social media, which requires, at a minimum, a return to the ownership limits of the 1934 Communications Act. 4. Recognize the Internet as a public utility subject to the Constitution and Bill of Rights, particularly the First Amendment. 5. Recognize the original 13th Amendment that was surreptitiously removed from the Constitution in the chaos following the Civil War, which forbids U.S. citizens from accepting titles of nobility such as Esquire, that is, attorneys with fealty, witting or unwitting, to the International Bar Association, controlled by the independent financial district known as the City of London. This would invalidate a number of laws passed by Congress since 1819 that have usurped the sovereignty of the people. 6. Return the Constitution to its original intent that the federal government is limited to the express powers enumerated therein and nothing more, just as the Articles of Confederation before it also stipulated. 7. Organize a National Assembly of the United States based on Article 5 of the Constitution, which provides a means for passing amendments, including a provision for conventions in 3/4 of the state. 8. Convene common law grand juries. Although these citizens' initiatives have come to be associated with reactionary organizations that combine anti-government sentiments and bigotry, the framework of these bodies is such that they can be used by progressives to seek remedy from the misuse of our government by foreign corporate criminal elements. 9. Encourage jury annulment, which allows any jury to judge an accused as not culprit, even if the jury knows that the accused is guilty according to the law as it is written. 10. Reestablish the rigors of empirical reasoning, scientific method, and logic. 11. Support the formation of alternative global value exchanges to replace the chokehold of the cartel's private currency, so-called Federal Reserve Notes, as the de facto world currency. For these tools to be effective requires that sufficient numbers of people understand A, the root cause of global dysfunction is private control over money creation, B, the cartel, through ownership of the media, polling organizations, and electronic voting machines, in addition to the educational process, aims to make citizens feel that they are a powerless minority, and C, the necessity of each person taking responsibility for his or her own spiritual evolution, which serves as the basis for the sharing of resources, that we examine in the next chapter, the seventh and final step required for global transformation. From behind the curtain, this is Bob Bowes.
Bob Bowes' commentary is excerpted from his book, Seven Steps to Global Economic and Spiritual Transformation, which can be found at your local booksellers and online. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org.
For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.